I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. October is Autism Awareness Month. One in 68 people live with autism, and even though thousands of Canadians are diagnosed each year, there are still a lot of misconceptions about it and about the abilities of those who live with it. Andrea Bull joins me now. Her brother Robert was diagnosed when he was 4 years old. An adult now, he and Andrea have just published a new children's book, Animal Appetites. It's a colorful, educational ABC book depicting animals and their favorite snacks. Andrea wrote the book while Robert illustrated it. They hope with its publication they can help end the stigma surrounding autism by raising awareness. Ms. Bull joins me now to talk about this book, her brother Robert, and the importance of changing how autism is viewed in our discourse and our culture. Andrea Bull is a registered audiologist here in Vancouver. Robert lives and works in Penticton. The book is published by Hungry Hungry Publishing. The website to buy the book is at animalappetitesbook.com. Please welcome to the Platta Online program in person today, Andrea Bull. Ms. Bull, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So Robert was diagnosed with autism at four, is that right?
Yeah.
So is that something that you can tell at an early age?
Not at that time specifically. It was 20-something years ago when there was very little in the way of diagnoses and sort of warning signs and that kind of thing. It's come a long way since then, but my mom noticed first that he was a quiet kid. He was really quiet and didn't really respond to his name all that often. And at one point she thought he was deaf or that he had a hearing problem. So they got his hearing checked early on, and that was fine because he wasn't really responsive. You'd walk up behind him and you'd call him Robbie, Robbie, and he, you know, wouldn't turn around and wouldn't really be very present. And so she knew something was a little bit off. And then they tested his hearing and everything seemed fine then. But he had a really hard time learning language at the time. And so that was more of a red flag than anything else.
And nowadays, can they test that while the mother is pregnant, say? Test for that, I should say?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. And I guess it takes, it doesn't manifest itself at birth, I suppose. It does, in Robert's case, it took 4 years, right?
Right, and it could have been there since birth. Mm-hmm. There was lots of publicity about vaccines and this, that, and the other that could have been there, but it's really hard to tell whether he was born that way or if it was an environmental factor of some kind, but now it's just something that he lives with, so.
Well, we hear a lot about that, about the discussions about the causes of autism. I don't know how much you want to discuss that, but I mean, you mentioned vaccines, you mentioned the environmental nature, but I mean, there have been autistic people throughout history, haven't there? Through mankind, I guess.
Definitely.
So, in terms of what causes it, have you got any thoughts on that?
Not really, and I find that when, especially in my family anyway, we don't really talk about the cause because it doesn't really matter at this point for us as a family because it is what it is and we wouldn't really want him any other way. You know, it's just we've grown up with him that way and he's an integral part of our family the way that he is. So it's not worth looking back now. We might as well look forward and do what we can in the future.
So they describe it as being on a spectrum. So there are, there's mild forms of it, I guess, and then there are sort of, I don't know what you call that, severe forms or?
It's sort of a low functioning up to high functioning or Asperger's type of autism on the spectrum. And I would say Robbie falls somewhere in the mid to low.
Yeah.
After lots of training and lots of work with him as a kid with my parents and lots of support workers, he can do a lot of things on his own now.
So there's no cure, obviously, but there is training, there is work that one can do.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's different for, that's sort of why it's a spectrum, is it's different for every child. Every child can do some things or is weaker in some areas or has certain savantisms or has certain discomforts of things. And so they all fall on a scale somewhere. And the type of intervention that each person needs is very, very individual and very specific to how they experience the world.
Back to causes for just a sec. Mm-hmm. It can happen to anybody, any family. Can encounter this.
As far as I know, I'm not sure. I haven't looked recently about any genetic testing or anything like that that could be a predictor. I know that there is a genetic link at some degree, but I'm not sure about the rest of the diagnosis now.
Robert today is in Penticton. Mm-hmm. What's his day like?
Well, he likes his routine, as most autistic people do. Yeah. He gets up in the morning. He does his own hygiene routine, which sort of was taught to him a really long time ago. And he can make himself breakfast and he can pack himself a lunch. Very simple things, you know, cereal, a sandwich. Mm-hmm. He gets all the basic food groups. He knows he has to have some vegetables, he has to have a piece of fruit, and so he can put that all together. Then he waits for the handy dart that picks him up to take him to the Association for Community Living in Penticton. They're a great employer for a lot of people with disabilities, autism especially. They've been really, really good to him. He goes there as their janitor, mm-hmm. so they show him a routine. He'll do that same routine sort of every day for 30 years, unwavering quality, and mm-hmm. Once he's shown something once, he's able to do it over and over. So he works as the janitor there and then helps out in the bike shop cleaning up every once in a while as well.
And this is the importance of a routine.
Mm-hmm.
For him, it must be work, but I mean, we all react to work the same way. I guess it's work, right?
Exactly.
But does he enjoy the routine that he has?
I think so. I think he enjoys the routine specifically, that it is a routine. He doesn't really like to be thrown off that uh-huh. very often. He likes to make sure that he sees his certain shows. He knows that he has to have certain things done by a certain time to get on the bus and to come home.
And he was always artistic, even as a kid?
Yeah, he would sit and draw, and he still does. My parents would bring home all their recycling from their offices just so he would have paper, because he'd be burning through those and pencils and pencil crayons like nobody's business. We couldn't even slow him down for the most part, so he's been drawing ever since I can remember.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the photos, the drawings and the illustrations in the book, which he did, and they're quite good, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're you can tell that he spent a lot of time, but you can also tell that he's done it a long time.
Yeah, and it's very imaginative. He really thinks about what he's doing, I think.
Yeah.
Which is really easy to see through those pictures.
And it's a fun book because these animals eat food. Mm-hmm. I mean, you wrote it, so they eat food. Like, what's this here? Xenops eat, how do you pronounce it?
Zemenias.
Zemenias in x-ray machines.
Yeah.
And he's captured that in his illustration.
Yeah, and that was one of our challenges. Was X was particularly hard in an ABC book at the best of times, but he had to Google it on the iPad. He had to use a couple more skills to figure out what is a Zemenia, what is a Xenops. So it was a little bit more of an engaging part of the manuscript, which I liked as well.
So Xenops is a bird, apparently.
Yep.
Yeah. So how did you guys work in terms of doing this? You wrote the lines, and then he would fill them in with his illustrations afterwards?
Yeah, I started thinking I should make a book of his art for our parents as a gift, just because he has so much of it, and if it's in a book, then they can get rid of some of the hard copies and clean out some of the paper. But then I was sort of just, in my free time, starting to write creatively, and this was one of the challenges. I just thought, let's just do this on the side for fun to see what happens. And then once I had sort of A to Z, I thought, I wonder what would come of it if he wrote or drew the pictures to this. And so I just sent it off and said, you know, Mom, have him draw these things and see what he says. Tell him I want to make a book. And he said, okay, all right, fine. And so he started drawing. And then as I was getting them back one by one, I just thought, wow, these are incredible. And even for me, I never expected that kind of work to come back. So,
well, they're great alliterations, and then his illustrations obviously are quite wonderful to look at. You write at the beginning of the book that we are all capable of incredible things.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this book is an example of that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what we're hoping, that it'll act, you know, anybody, regardless of the challenges that you face, if you have the right support, a lot of great things can happen. And just because you can't get to the same ends one way doesn't mean that if you take a different approach or have different support systems available that you can't get there just in a different form.
You mentioned your parents earlier. In terms of just how important it is for the family in terms of supporting their loved ones, your family obviously has supported Robert a great deal. That worked for him, didn't it? I mean, he is functioning, isn't he?
Yeah, and probably a lot more so than he could have been. My parents put in a lot of work. I remember even some of my earliest memories of my mom with Smarties, trying to teach him to speak, you know, say milk, and you get your red Smartie, and just over and over. Or he had a lot of sensory trouble where he couldn't wear, we lived in Manitoba at the time and it was 30 below, and he couldn't wear sort of long sleeves or long pants, but you can't send a kid to school in shorts and a t-shirt in the middle of the winter without raising some suspicion. So they had to use steel wool on his skin to desensitize it and get him weighted vests so he could sit. And we moved to Prince Rupert, and there wasn't a lot of support in the classroom for him, and my mom was a huge advocate. She would go to school every day and sit in that classroom and just say, I'm not leaving until you give me a worker. My son needs help, and I will be here every day. And it was early on in the times of autism and how that needed support. So the work that she did with him was, I think, integral, especially routines. She would never let him sit at the same spot at the table, never take the same route to school. You never wear the same outfit twice. She didn't want him to get used to it because she had two other kids to deal with. And my dad worked away a lot at that time. And so she was there, you know, sort of saying, this is, you're going to fit in with everybody else because I don't have the time or energy to do special treatment here. So
how are schools doing in terms of integrating students with young people who have autism? I mean, have you found a great improvement? I mean, I remember in, because I'm 33, and so I left high school, I guess, in 2000. And there were students in our class, even in elementary school, that had autism. And you know, there's one or two, but no more than that, say. What are schools like today in your experience?
I think they're pretty good compared to what they used to be. My brother was really lucky. He went to a lot of schools that had a lot of support specifically, and his high school was really, really good to him. They, you know, he's a gentle giant. Everybody loves him. He's really polite and really soft-spoken and really very nice, so he was always beloved by the workers that worked with him. But I think there's a lot more support for kids now, especially if they're diagnosed early. They can get access to a lot of those things. And schools are just doing a little bit better now to help, you know, even kids that are just a little bit behind in reading or dyslexia, very, you know, sort of mild forms of a disability, and they have support now too. So I think it's getting better.
Yeah, so the future looks better, but I mean, we still have lots to do, and we'll touch on sort of the misconceptions that there are in popular culture. But is that something that you and your parents have talked about in terms of the future with Robert? I mean, in terms of lifespan, I mean, they live as long as everyone else does, right?
Yeah, exactly. And probably more so because, you know, you say, Rob, you got to be healthy, you got to do exercise, you got to eat vegetables. So he's, you know, doing
far
an exercise routine
than...
every day. Yeah, exactly. So he'll probably outlive us all, I would think.
Yeah. So what sort of conversations have you guys been having as a family in terms of what the future will be for Robert?
Well, my mom wants to keep him with them for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. But he's also, you know, a young guy who doesn't necessarily want to be with his parents all the time. So they specifically, their new house now has a basement suite for, or not quite a suite, but a basement area for him where he has a bathroom, his bedroom, a TV room, so he can spend time. And they give him a lot of independence to make his own meals. You know what you need to do. You need to get ready. If you need help, you just come and get us. But in the future, you know, they always had a plan for him if they were to be in a car accident together or something like that. And they might... Dad put a lot of work into financially planning his future, and he works, so he's making money, and it's just going right into a bank account and investments, and they have they want him to be very financially independent from myself and my brother, so that if they were to go, we could have a house with a suite, and he could pay rent for that suite, and it wouldn't really be a burden on us, or if we're going on family vacations, and we want to take him along, he can pay his own way, you know, he's not sort of a burden in any way financially, which he would never be anyway, but they want it. They want to make sure it stays that way, and things can always change. So,
And the support in the community, I mean, we've talked about what happens in schools, but he's an adult, so you know, he's like everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Are there resources for him in case, like just in sort of day-to-day stuff?
There are. The Handy Dart is a great support to get him to where he needs to be. And the Association for Community Living in Victoria got him his first job at the Red Cross. And he was a janitor there for years and years and years. So it's organizations like that that take on individuals with autism as employees, which have made a huge difference. They, you know, keeps him social to some degree.
Yeah.
Keeps him, you know, from just sitting around in the house all day doing nothing. It gives him a purpose and makes him feel, you know, important. He's got to be somewhere. He's got to do something to help these people out, and I think that makes him feel quite useful.
And how have, say, businesses in our part of the world here in Vancouver, British Columbia, if you will, because Robert's in Penticton, how have they been in terms of providing employment to people with autism?
It seems quite well. I wasn't ever really involved in the process more than just hearing about it, but I know that... I believe it was the Association for Community Living that got him all of his jobs. So they must have a list of community partners that are willing to take on certain individuals for certain roles, depending on what their capabilities are. So that's been very good. I'm not sure how extensive that network is, and I think it could even extend beyond some of those things, not just janitorial services and things like that. They're, you know, would be great at data entry and all kinds of things that take a lot of precision because they are so focused. You know, I think about half the things I do, and the quality could waver from day to day depending on how tired I am, whereas they, when Robbie does a job, it's done 100%, exactly the same 110% of the time, so...
So we could do better as a society, couldn't we?
I think so, yeah.
Better integrating. I mean, we all encounter people with autism, you know, on the bus, on the street, in restaurants and the sort. And as you said, there are jobs that people can, that people with autism can do.
Yes.
And I guess businesses need to do better.
And I think that starts with the conversation,
exactly.
Changing the conversation from what they can't do to what can they do. Everybody has limitations, all kinds of limitations. So what are your strengths? What can you do with them? How do those fit into regular society and everyday work situations? And as long as you focus on that and find what works, I think they can be very successful, just like anyone else. You know, anybody else would take the exact same approach to finding a job or finding a career. So why not expand that?
Have you found it, not so easy, but I mean, speaking to you these last few minutes, you've obviously... found it easy to talk about all of this.
Yes, yeah.
So when you talk to other people, people that you encounter, say, on the street and sort, there are gaps in terms of our knowledge, isn't there, when it comes to autism? Sometimes we don't know what to say.
No,
So how do we start changing the conversation, if you will?
I think it's hard because autism is such an open black box. You know, it means all kinds of things. There's a million different challenges that every different individual could face. So it's very hard for people to understand it because it doesn't sort of fit into a box. You can't say, oh, this is what autism is, or this is what that person struggles with, because everybody is so different. So I feel like when someone... has autism, they need to be, from a very young age, defined by who they are, not what they have. And so as a kid, if he's an artist, that was very, very clear. And so instead of saying, oh, this is my autistic son, this is my artist son, or this is my son that's very into art, and he happens to have autism. And these happen to be some of the challenges he faces. Or, you know, I was a really independent, smart kid, and the challenges I had were staying quiet in class and staying busy enough to not, you know, drive my teacher crazy. I had my own set of challenges. Mm-hmm. And so why do those kids need to be treated any differently? Now, there's quite a few autistic individuals that are very low functioning, nonverbal, that can't do a lot of things, that need a lot of extra support. But that doesn't mean that there's one thing or something that could be expanded on that they could be successful at, or...
Yeah, unfortunately, our culture, our society tends to label people, and then if we don't understand the labels, we automatically don't even try to.
No, exactly.
And so that right away ceases the conversation, if you will.
Yeah,
and we thrive on the misconceptions and the whatever we want to think about, the worst things sometimes,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
I guess the most obvious place where this starts is popular culture, because when we see something depicted in either film, television, or in books, that can change how we think about
very
certain
much
so. Things. So, so in terms of the depiction of people with autism on television, for example, I know the number of programs and TV shows in the last few years have characters who have autism.
Yes, yeah.
So that's changed, obviously, in the last 20 years, say.
Yep.
Are those accurate, say, the way that... I mean, there's a detective on... I don't watch the show Bones, but apparently one of the detectives has a form of autism.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So what have you found in terms of how it's discussed or depicted in popular culture?
It's hard because they could be very accurate depictions of a certain number of individuals that are functioning in that way to that level.
Yeah.
Because it's so varied, they can't really say that it's not, because there could be, but...
Yeah, well, see, we all assume that it's either the Sean Penn character in I Am Sam or Rain Man.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I can't think of one that's a low-functioning that I've seen in a film in recent years, but...
No.
The Awakenings, the Robert De Niro character in that. So I guess that's a place where the conversation can change, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think a lot of those are not necessarily sensationalizing, but highlighting the savantism that a lot of autistic children have, or adults. And that, because it's so interesting and it's so curious, and we all wish that we were able to do something like that. So that is particularly highlighted in most of those characters. But it could easily show them being a lot more normal, or quotations normal, to some degree, and a little bit more functioning in certain ways.
That's why they call it a spectrum, because there are, like people. People with autism don't really have the same sort of autism,
right.
do they?
Right? No.
And that's another thing that I think we think about. I mean, when we think of someone who's autistic, we think of Dustin Hoffman and Rain Man, other than, you know, someone that is highly functional.
Right, yeah.
What have you learned about Robert in terms of putting this book together, during the process of putting it together? Because, I mean, writing a book is, as you are well aware, it's often very difficult, getting it published and the sort. Getting Robert to do the illustrations, I mean, you learn again that he's a great artist.
Yeah.
So have you learned anything about him?
I have, and sort of about myself. I learned that he's getting a little bit stubborn as he gets older, because his routine is getting a little bit more solidified than it ever had to be. So working around that and not, you know, stressing him out too much, keeping it a positive experience, but just that he likes when you give him clear, defined task, he'll do it, and then he's done. He doesn't really want to hear about how the progress is. He doesn't really want to see the proofs on the computer, and he just wants to see the final product.
Yeah.
Okay, here, I did my part. Show me what has come of it now. He likes it to be nice and clear. He doesn't want to be involved in the whole thing. He's already on to thinking about making a video game or an app and a movie and a comic book. And I'm thinking, oh, geez, he's going to be taxing my resources even at best. But
there you go. You guys can come up with a series of books even, right? So he has seen the book and he likes it?
He does, yeah. He was surprised that it looks this way, just because he hadn't seen anything other than his drawings for the most part, because he didn't really care. But now that he's seen it, and he sort of has flipped through it himself and reads the About Autism page and things like that, and knows what's happening with it, now he's getting more excited about it.
Yeah, it is. It's very well done in terms of how they put it together.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think Robert wants us to know about autism and about him?
It's funny, I ask him that every once in a while. What would you tell someone else with autism?
Yeah.
And he says, well, that you can just do anything you want. Be an inventor, be a scientist, do whatever you like. And that's coming from the perspective of someone who has a lot of support. And, you know, if he says he wants to do something, we, as a family, generally try to find a way to make that happen. So he, I think, he just doesn't want people to think that he's stupid. He wants people to know that sometimes he can't say what he's trying to say in a way that's clear to other people. So he's a little bit nervous about media interviews and things like that, because he doesn't think people will understand him the way that he speaks, even though he speaks quite eloquently every once in a while. I think he just doesn't want people to feel like he's stupid or not good at something, because he's good at a lot of things.
There are great lessons in terms of learning about you guys and reading this book and what's in it.
Mm.
I mean, and I guess the lesson that I've taken away is that we need to be more compassionate.
Yes.
We need to be more understanding, and we need to be patient.
Yes.
And those are lessons that we need anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
And we lose sight of those things.
Definitely.
It's been a pleasure meeting you, and a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you.
October is Autism Awareness Month, as I mentioned off the top. What else should we be thinking about in terms of, say, autism, and what can we do? I know that if we buy the book, proceeds go to the Canucks Autism Network, is that right?
Yeah. They're an organization that provides a lot of different services. You know, they have sports, arts, dance, all these kinds of programs to support people with autism, and they're very, very successful in doing so. And so we wanted to make sure that, you know, this is just an example of what one person can do with some support, and we wanted to give back to the autism community by profit sharing whatever comes from this book and donating it back, so that other people can sort of reach their goals and dreams.
And you guys already have done a great job in raising awareness, and I appreciate you coming in today.
Thanks
for this. The website for more, animalappetitesbook.com, that's where you can buy the book, and then there are also resources there. You can download PDFs and the sort of, if you want to learn more, I can't remember, what is it, lesson plans?
There's activity sheets, coloring and printing practice that can go along with it while you're working through.
There you go. The book is called Animal Appetites, a Book of Unusual ABCs. It's from Hungry Hungry Publications. It's illustrated by Robert J. Bull. It's author Andrea Bull. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.